The Guardian.
The joy of ebooks is that great stories are just a click away. For our podcast listeners, we have a great offer on Luke Harding's book Mafia State, a menacing tale of life as a journalist in present-day Russia. I'll tell you more at the end of the show.
The Guardian Books Podcast with Claire Armistead.
They all laughed at Christopher Columbus when he said the world was round. They all laughed when...
Hello, and welcome to this walk round Cambridge. To begin with, you should be standing somewhere on King's Parade.
Some of London's thoroughfares seem to be more well-known than others. Take the Caledonian Road. It's about a mile and a half long, almost joining the A1, or the Holloway Road, to the north, and Pentonville Road, King's Cross, to the south.
The Brunelleschi Dome, Michelangelo's David. Discover the history and treasures of Florence.
Audio guide to the London Underground, Docklands Light Railway, and London Overground. Part one of this audio guide is a talking map guiding you through the London Underground, Docklands Light Railway, and London Overground.
There it is, Wendy. Second star to the right and straight on till morning.
We actually made a map of the country on a scale of a mile to the mile. It has never been spread out, and the farmers objected. They said it would cover the whole country and shut out the sunlight. So now we use the country itself as its own map. And I assure you, it does nearly as well.
What do maps mean to you? The diagram that gets you through the underground or metro system every day? The illuminated globe in the corner of your bedroom? Those charts on the wall when you were at school with all the British bits picked out in pink. That's what we'll be discussing this week with two leading cartophiles, Jerry Broughton and Simon Garfield, both of whom have just published books on the history of cartography. We'll be hearing about both of them. But first, Jerry and Simon, I have something really, really, really special to show you. Surely this is map porn.
It's a huge thing.
This is mapping the city, and it's a coffee table book which is published by a Paris publisher, and it's a history of maps of cities, and it goes all the way from a second century BC Egyptian tomb map, which arguably is just a diagram of a garden, to the maps of the New York Metro from the 1940s.
They're extraordinary because it does give you this diversity, doesn't it, of the way in which the city's being represented. But I don't know what Simon thinks, but what strikes me is that just this extraordinary difference. I mean, a lot of these don't look actually like maps. I mean, if you're thinking of an Ordnance Survey map with trig lines and contour lines, I mean, there are all kinds of different sort of representations of the city going on here, which is sort of under the rubric of mapping.
Exactly.
We both know it's kind of all over the place.
If you suffer from vertigo, you're going to have a hard time with some of these as well. And a lot of them are just kind of views with kind of famous landmarks on them. You know, it is map porn, and that's kind of the glory of it. That's sort of what, what got me into it, I think, as well, just the fact that they work on so many levels. So they do get at you around, and they do get you from A to Z, but it is that kind of fantastic thing of you know, obviously something we've totally lost now with our mobile phones, you know, the idea that you get a fantastic sense of place and the world.
There's a map of Maastricht there which looks like a human brain.
But, you know, this goes off in all sorts of directions. So you say that, and then you say, well, actually, you know, the way in which a world map looks does to some extent try and mimic the idea of the body. You know, we both know about whole histories about the way in which a map is a metaphor for the human body. And so this is the thing about maps. It can go in all kinds of different directions. You look at some of these and you think, ah, very scientific. You look at others and you see very playful ones. You see maps of war. You can take the field in all different directions. And I think that's what was interesting about what we both did, that we both did two very different approaches to how you think about maps. You know, I just took 12, and Simon moved around. I think it would be fair to say being led by the stories of people's lives, how they encountered maps. And this is one of the things. It's a really, really difficult subject actually to write about in a funny way. I think, again, we both did that because we know that there isn't a lot of really good writing on maps. There's a lot of very good academic dry historical work on maps.
And there were some wonderful, huge books like this, you know, lots of exhibition catalogues and lots of kind of lovely things. A lot of which, finally, I mean, one of my favourite books is the Blau Atlas that's been, and you talk about as well, you write about, obviously, and it's been reproduced. You know, I think more and more people are kind of realising, actually, you know, you can go to libraries and see it, but you certainly can't afford to buy these things, but you can spend, I'm not sure how much this is. Should we have a quick look?
Some applications.
It is, yeah. Exactly.
Anyway, I'm going to stop you there. That's enough of that book. Put it away, boys. You're getting carried away. We're now going to move on to your own rather smaller books, but books which actually do offer a history of this huge subject. You mentioned a little bit about the difference between your books, and what actually struck me was that in a bit of a Borgesian way, they're actually maps of maps, aren't they? Because you're providing historical map through the subject of map making.
Yeah.
And I'd like you both to set out your stall. So, Jerry, yours is a history of the world in 12 maps. You're a professor of Renaissance studies at Queen Mary's College London. And I'm very interested in the structure you've adopted, because it is chronological, but it's also thematic.
Yeah, I mean, what I realised is that the 12 maps, and they're all world maps, again, slightly different from what Simon's doing, that he'll look at some local maps, but mine is very much about world mapping and 12 moments where different histories and different cultures map the world. And it's logical to each of those cultures. You know, it makes sense. You know, now we work in an online world where it seems to make sense. Although looking at the Apple maps recently, or maybe they're not, maybe we haven't progressed that much. But there's a way in which what it does is says for each culture, that world is understandable. So the Hereford Map of Monday from 1300 makes absolute sense to people who live in Hereford in 1300. And it's driven by defining principles of that culture. So in that case, it is very much a religious world map. So you look at the Greeks and Ptolemy, it's driven very much by an interest in geometry and science. And we go right up to date and look at Google Earth and think about digital online kinds of representation. So that's really what it was about. I mean, I've been doing maps for 20 years. I did a PhD on maps. I wrote academic books on it. But again, I think what I wanted to do was show, rather like Simon's subtitle, how the world looks like it does. And to say it's not a story just about progress. We haven't just got better and better and better. People at different times make a big investment in accuracy. But it's only very recent, so only since the 18th century with Cassini and then the 19th century Ordnance Survey. Before that, people have very different interests in why a map is so fascinating and what a map does for you. And so that was really the attempt to just say we can tell this story and we can tell moments of world history through maps. You know, we talk about our world picture. What is our world picture? And of course, it's very much also a cartographic idea as well as a philosophical idea. And, you know, maps are one of the great neglected subjects. You know, Simon will agree with this, I'm sure. There's no academic field for studying cartography. Geographers don't study them very much. I come out of literature. I do English. I teach Shakespeare. And a lot of people who are interested in the history of cartography come from different fields, international relations, archaeology, anthropology. So it's very, very interesting. We're absolutely fascinated by them, but they don't really have a field to themselves. I think that's the final point I'd make. That's the real worry. Geographers and cartographers at the moment are not at the forefront of defining maps. So online maps are not being made by people in institutional academic positions, which is what historically has always happened.
Simon, your book is On the Map, Why the World Looks the Way It Does. You're a bit of a gadabout, aren't you? You've written books about typefaces and the colour mauve. What brought you to maps and what is your project?
I've always been interested in maps, really. I think since just taking one stop on the tube every morning as a schoolboy, you look at the map and you actually think, isn't that a lot to explore? And then you think, hang on, this is only London and the suburbs. And then I think really from then. But it's interesting, as Jerry says, cartographers aren't defining the maps now. But I always sort of had my interest in maps more rooted in history, I think, than geography. And in fact, my big confession is that I was taught geography at school briefly for a term by Mike Brearley before he went on to become the England career cricket captain. But it was clear that there were, even from the London Tube map, so many wonderful stories to tell about maps. And that's really, you know, my background is journalistic. And I've done, I'm not sure, but about 40 stories.
You've got quite a lot of anecdotes interspersed between the chapters. So, for example, J.M. Barrie fails to fold a pocket map on page 311, and women can't read maps, oh really, on page 366. Tell us about those.
The J.M. Barrie thing is extraordinary, really. He was walking around Edinburgh, and wherever he went in Edinburgh, people were promoting, every bookshop he went into, people were promoting this wonderful new pocket map. And he sort of says, oh, you know, they're hard not to buy one at the counter, really. And then is absolutely furious that he can't fold it back. So it's a fantastically easy thing to fold out, especially in the show. It's a bit like when you go to Hamley's and a magician performs a trick and then actually you take it home and realise, no, you can't do it. And the Women Can't Read Maps, Oh Really chapter is really about how traditionally the myth is, and I begin with talking about, you know, this hugely successful book called
Why Women Don't Listen and Women Can't Read Maps, Beyond the Toilet Seat Being
exactly
Up.
Exactly, right. So the authors dropped the Beyond the Toilet Seat Being Up, and then this thing became a huge success. And the myth of women not reading maps really came about because the maps are made by men. And there is, there's now been a huge amount of academic research into this, into how men and women read things and look at with different spatial abilities. And the sort of simple way of explaining it, I suppose, is that men love coordinates and they see things sort of up ahead. Women generally remember maps, remember where they're going, far more by landmarks. And Richard Dawkins very much has a theory that the maps were the things that sort of made us human more than language at the beginning. There was a big thing that sort of expanded our brains, and that's connected with the way we lived and the sort of the hunter-gatherer element of the way our brains developed as well. So it was the classic thing, men going out to hunting, having to know about spatial differences far more and having a sort of far sort of broader idea of the land.
You're writing about as your main stories. Okay, carry on everybody. Thank you.
My name's Lara Mubaydeen. I'm 16 years old and I go to the British School Al Khabarit in Abu Dhabi. I think that a map is anything that can guide you through something that's unfamiliar to you, whether it's a geographical map, whether it's a tool to use for your learning, like a plan for an essay or something like that.
Hey, hi, I'm Omar Chamandi. A map is an abstract recording of reality that communicates information about our surroundings and the relationships between the elements in our surroundings.
I have a different view on maps. I think that everything is a map. Like, if you look at windows on a building, it's a map of the rooms in a building. And also, like, squares on the floor, they're like maps of how it was built. Say Google, for example, you zoom into, like, everything's set to squares. So you zoom into a square, there's another square. So there are maps within maps within maps.
Hi, I'm Miss Fleming. I'm head of media at the British School and I use maps all the time for revision tools, and I also, at the end of the lesson, use them as plenaries to help with visual learning and also at kinesthetic learning.
In these terms, you're talking about mind maps rather than...
Yes, mind maps to track learning. Because over the years, I've found more and more students are visual and also kinesthetic, and by doing like a map to track what we've done, they find them very useful to add to it when we do other things in class and also for revision. And we do all different maps. Some might do it like with little trees and branches. Some might do an area, just one big area, and have lots of different colours for different keywords. They're really quite individual.
I've got a map at home that I bought in the UAE, and what's interesting is, as there's some conflict between most of the Middle East and Israel, the map I have has Israel cut out. The landmass that was formerly known as Israel is now part of the West Bank.
Now let's go back to the right to the beginning, and you both start with Ptolemy. What I found absolutely astonishing was that he discovered longitude and latitude.
He offers the first really scientific way of mapping the whole world. And it's very late. It's 150 AD. So there are very rudimentary ways in which the Greeks have started to understand latitude and longitude. But he drops this grid, what geographers call a graticule, a grid of latitude and longitude across the world. And it's a very scientific, geometrical way of showing the whole world. And I always think of it as like a toolkit. What Ptolemy does in 150 AD, he writes the geography and he says, this is how you can make a map. And I always think it's a bit like battleships. Here's a grid, and here's 8,000 places that we know in the world, and you just basically plug them in once you've got your grid, and it's great, and off you go.
And it's unclear, isn't it, whether or not he ever drew a map himself.
It's one of the great mysteries that neither of us are going to ever solve, that, you know, the book doesn't seem to have maps, and it disappears for over 1,000 years. It doesn't reappear until late 12th, 13th century Byzantium. And then people draw the maps, but it's not clear whether Ptolemy ever did. And I think that's one of the great things.
It's like having an atlas with only the index.
You know, the Greeks know exactly about the globe, the size and circumference of the globe, and they know, therefore, that we live on a globe and that you can create this geometrical sphere, and then you can start to fill in, as it were, the blanks, and you think, what's beyond the horizon? And that is the wonderful conceit of a map. What a map does is you look at the horizon, you go, what's over there? And you want to discover that, but you also need to somehow abstract it. You need to put some limits on the world because it's so big.
Yes.
And it's so sensuous and it's wonderful. And that's what I think the Greeks start to do.
They and it was actually a mixture, wasn't it, of science, of that kind of science, combining with Alexandria being the sort of new capital of the world in a way, and sailors and explorers coming in from all over with new information and new maps, which the great library at Alexandria would then say, actually, thank you, we'll have that.
And actually, of course, the history of the disappearance of this map is tied in with that huge historical tragedy, really, of the burning down of the great library of Alexandria.
Yeah, it is. And I always say in the book that it's quite interesting that you need that moment of the culture to be at its absolute zenith, so all that knowledge to be there. And basically, the Greco-Roman world is slightly in decline. And that's when Ptolemy can write the book. He probably couldn't have written it 200 years earlier. But then, as you say, then that's the tragedy because it disappears for 1,000 years. Well, it doesn't disappear because, of course, what happens is it goes east and it goes into Arabic and Islamic culture. And that we still don't know about. That's one of the great things that I think both of our books are saying, you know what? We haven't discovered everything about this story. There are all kinds of other avenues that we can still develop. And that's one of the great stories. I don't think Ptolemy disappears. He disappears for a Western audience. And we've still got stuff to learn about what on earth people were doing with Ptolemy in Baghdad in the 5th and 6th centuries.
Now let's jump forward to the Renaissance and Mercator. What is the importance of Mercator? I mean, he's been superseded, obviously. It's a very old map, isn't it?
It's the great projection. I mean, what he does is he produces a projection where you can navigate, and it enables you on a flat piece of paper to draw a straight line from A to B, but take into account the curvature of the Earth. Yeah? So all maps before this, I just presume that the world basically, I mean, they knew the world wasn't round, but they'd approached it on a map as though it was. So obviously, if you draw a straight line from, you know, Lisbon to Jamaica, it actually should be a curved line across the curvature of the Earth's surface. So Mercator developed this ingenious projection, which effectively, to put it rather crudely, Simon and I will say, he just stretched the map north and south. So that's why on a Mercator map you see the north and south poles stretched to infinity. So it looks a bit rubbish at the north and south poles, but it enables you to sail east to west.
Now, there's another point about Mercator, isn't it, that technology was moving on, so he could do copper plate maps.
Yeah, so the maps are really beautiful. I mean, Nick Crane did a great biography of Mercator talking about this. And, you know, there's a whole community of us who talk through this, and Nick was really helpful in helping me with Mercator about the fact that, yeah, he is. You've got to think of the Low Countries at this time as being a bit like Silicon Valley, and everything's, you know, new and exciting, and mapping the globe is completely new. Nobody's been mapping the terrestrial globe. But it's also a period of religious conflict. And what I say in the book is what we completely miss is Mercator's arrested for heresy. He's nearly executed in 1544. And I think that the map is a rather transcendental image as well of saying, let's try and rise up above all these religious conflicts and persecution that I've had myself. And that's really what the map's doing. Because, of course, we both know, because we're dreamers, we believe that maps are transcendent and they're exciting and they show a world of wonder. Probably why we're both a bit down on online maps, because they're really about selling you stuff. And I think that's what Mercator's map's about. It's about rising up above the world in this sort of godlike perspective, looking down and saying, isn't the world a wonderful place? His map doesn't have any political lines or boundaries on it.
He had bought a large map representing the sea without the least vestige of land. and the crew were much pleased when they found it to be a map they could all understand. What's the good of Mercator's North Poles and Equators, tropics, zones and meridian lines? So the bellman would cry, and the crew would reply, they are merely conventional signs. Other maps are such shapes with their islands and capes, but we've got our brave captain to thank, so the crew would protest, that he's brought us the best, a perfect and absolute blank.
And then it went to France and Cassini, whose name is most familiar now from the Cassini project, which is mapping Mars, which I think is rather wonderful. Tell us about the Cassinis. A dynasty of map makers.
They're a dynasty of map makers from the very late 17th century and throughout late 17th and into the 18th century. They're starting to develop a new method of mapping, which is a local method of mapping. It's using triangulation. You know, so I find it very interesting that in the book I talk about the way in which these very foundational geometrical principles shape mapping. So for the Greeks, it's the circle. Perfection of a circle, the Platonic circle. For the Chinese, really interestingly, the Chinese use the square to map because it's how they develop agriculture around this 3x3 square. The Cassinis then come along and say, let's use a triangle. So let's map little areas triangle by triangle using new methods of being able to survey the territory and map it very precisely. This is a whole new idea. And I just say it's around the development of the nation state because the nation needs to understand where it begins and where it ends.
And France was the biggest nation state at that time in
Europe. And France was the biggest nation state with a huge boundary. So, of course, the Ancien Régime is saying, right, we need to map it. We need to know exactly what we've got and what we didn't have. And there's a great story about the king who, when the first surveys come back, says, oh, good grief, we've lost about 15% of the area of France. We've lost more than in a battle because of what the geographers have done. But I think it does precede the Ordnance Survey, and we forget this story that the Cassinis are doing this extraordinary job. You know, they're going across every single inch of France and mapping it before the Ordnance Survey. And I guess it's just a story. I remember there was an occasion at the British Library where I did the teleseries, and we did a whole thing about who were the greatest national mapmakers. And I got really cross and said, as I think we both Simon and I would agree, there is no such thing as people who are great national mapmakers. Maps always transcend those kind of boundaries. That's what's great about all the mapmakers we talk about. They're always pushing the limits. And it's not about the English being better mapmakers than the French or the German. Mapmakers are always about showing a boundary and then saying, let's rip it out and do another one.
That's true. Although it is interesting, though, Claire, as you were saying, that how the power shifts in terms of what the cartographers, not only what they know, but the, in a way, the sort of the money and the energy that they expend on producing this beautiful map.
Could it possibly be something to do with the exposure to the sea and travelling and the having a mercantile economy that was facing outwards?
It is partly. I mean, it is certainly for the Portuguese. I mean, you were saying moving into the Renaissance, and there's no doubt that it is very interesting in the late 15th century that the country that suddenly kickstarts the Great Age of Discovery is Portugal, which at the time is probably the poorest and least developed country in Europe, because suddenly geography is its destiny. It's positioned right on the west coast of Europe, looking out to the Atlantic. So they say, what's out there? Let's go over there and let's go down the African coast. And of course, it's not the Italians, as people used to think, just because Columbus is from Genoa, that the Italians are driving this age of discovery. It's nonsense. It's the Portuguese who are starting it. And with that comes a mapping tradition, which is really important.
Okay, I'm going to move us a few centuries forward to the 20th century and the particular problems of the propaganda map, which came into sort of horrific focus, particularly in Germany during the Second World War.
There's no doubt that, you know, maps have always been about power and what you own, what you can show that you own.
Particularly the Hitler's ethnic map of Slovakia, which you cite, Jerry. Yeah. I was really struck by that, with big blobs where the Jewish and Gypsy populations were. It's not really a map, is it? It's a sort of genocide tool.
It is, absolutely. And of course, it's about what we've both been talking about, the power of the map to create this neutral representation. That's really how things are, right? That's what the map offers us some partial view of. We know that's actually not true, but it plays that game. And I think that what happens with those kind of propaganda maps, which work throughout the mid-20th century, is that there's a collision between what Simon was talking about. You know, maps are often about politics and power. If you can represent the territory, you can to some extent lay claim to it. But it also, I think, comes into collision with something that happens throughout the 19th century, which is the thematic map. So maps start to emerge which can be just about one thing. So you can have a map of the geology of the British Isles. You can have a map which is about unemployment or cholera, something that Simon talks about, or poverty, you know, Booth's maps. And then when, of course, you have very intemperate political ideologies which say, aha, well, we can do that. So we can then do a map which talks about the distribution of ethnic populations. And that, of course, can then help us to cleanse those areas. And that's what's really scary about it. And I think that really what we've done over the last 20 or 30 years is realise that compelling power of the map. And that's why I think there's been so much interest in it, saying the map is both something which is terribly exciting and it's very idealistic and it's transcendental, and it's very political and very dangerous and worrying. And so I think that's now why we're all quite fascinated by this terrain of the map, you know, who has control of the map.
And it brings us, that brings us to the Peters map, which I mentioned earlier, and we just must finish on the Peters map because it just seems such a key moment in 20th century, but it's still a hugely political map. He reorganised it to get rid of this Eurocentricity that we've been talking about. Right. Didn't he?
Yeah, there was a real kind of feeling which I find interesting. The one anecdote that we both tell, a very pointed anecdote, is this wonderful sequence in The West Wing.
And you are the Organization of Cartographers for Social Equality.
Plain and simple, we'd like President Bartlett to aggressively support legislation that would make it mandatory for every public school in America to teach geography using the Peters projection map instead of the traditional Mercator.
The Mercator projection has fostered European imperialist attitudes for centuries and created an ethnic bias against the Third World.
Really?
The German cartographer, Mercator, originally designed this map in 1569 as a navigational tool for European sailors.
The map enlarges areas at the poles to create straight lines of constant bearing or geographic direction.
So it makes it easier to cross an ocean.
But
yes,
it distorts the relative size of nations and continents.
Are you saying the map is wrong?
Oh dear, yes. Look at Greenland.
Okay.
Now look at Africa.
Okay.
The two land masses appear to be roughly the same size.
Yes.
Would it blow your mind if I told you that Africa is, in reality, 14 times larger?
Yes.
The idea is right, you know, that we've got the size of countries sort of fundamentally wrong because they weren't important at the time when the map was made.
I want to bring you back, Jerry, to the point you made about maps not getting any better necessarily. Surely since Apollo 17 went off and photographed the world from outer space, we have a factual record of what the Earth looks like, don't we?
Well, we do to some extent, and that's what the online maps are really telling us, that this is somehow photoreal. And it's very significant that when you use those maps, you'll see that, firstly, they don't use the language of maps. They don't have the contour lines, the trig points, because they're saying that they're not maps. They're saying they're geospatial applications. It doesn't roll off the tongue as easily. So there's a way in which, again, we're being told that this is actually now completely transparent representation of the world. But we know it's not. We know it's not because we know that you're still crunching data. It doesn't matter whether you're putting a map onto a piece of stone or onto a piece of parchment or you're printing it onto a piece of paper or it's going digital. You are still crunching basic data to put it into the format of some kind of map. That's what Apple do, it's what Google do. They take satellite data predominantly and they then sort of basically warp it. They put it online. And you know, you take any data that shows you the entirety of the world and you try and put it on a flat screen, because it's still on a screen, it's still on a flat screen when you look at it, you're producing a projection. And as both Simon and I know ad nauseum, any kind of projection of the whole Earth has to make decisions about what it emits as well as it puts on the map, and it will create distortions. So that's one of my concerns about the way, again, that online mapping is being sold to us, that apparently it's totally transparent, totally objective and totally real, and that's simply not the case. It's just not true.
The other point, I think, about the power of maps and the control that the cartographers have on maps has absolutely been extended now to the digital world as well. I mean, that's an absolutely kind of key point that I think the single most important application on all our digital devices now are maps and sort of location. You know, as Jerry said, they want to sell us things. And the surest way they can sell us things is to know where we are at any one particular point. You know, so there's no point selling us something in Venezuela if our map is in London. But they know our map is in London. They know we live in London because we enable location to help us get to the nearest whatever it is, garage or whatever.
So it's us wherever we happen to be exactly. And whatever we happen to
it
be
It used
in.
To be kind of A to Z. We used to get a big picture. Now it's a little screen. It's sort
with
of
our little car in the centre of the
exactly
world.
Exactly right. And it's me too. You know, meter Z. We are now so dependent on digital maps. You know, maps are absolutely more powerful than they've ever been.
That was Simon Garfield and Jerry Broughton. Jerry's A History of the World in 12 Maps is published by Alan Lane, and Simon's book, On the Map, Why the World Looks the Way It Does, is published by Profile. And if you'd like to see the book they were raving about at the start of the podcast, we have a gallery of pictures from mapping the city from antiquity to the 20th century on guardian.co.uk/books. Do go and have a look. It is absolutely fabulous. And that's all from us this week. Thanks to our readers, Lindsay Irving and Tim Mabey, who also produced the programme. We leave you with one of fiction's great cartophiles, The English Patient, explaining in Michael Ondaatje's luminous prose just what a lifesaver, a good mind for maps, can be.
The Bedouin were keeping me alive for a reason. I was useful, you see. Someone there had assumed I had a skill when my plane crashed in the desert. I am a man who can recognise an unnamed town by its skeletal shape on a map. I have always had information like a sea in me. I am a person who, if left alone in someone's home, walks to the bookcase, pulls down a volume and inhales it. So history enters us. I knew maps of the seafloor, maps that depict weaknesses in the shield of the earth, charts painted on skin that contain the various routes of the Crusades.
For a limited period only, we have an exclusive ebook offer for Guardian podcast listeners. Guardian columnist Luke Harding's Mafia State is a dark and ominous insight into the life of a journalist in present-day Russia. We're offering 30% off the list price of $4.99. All you have to do is go to the ebook store www.kobo.com, that's KOBO.com, and at checkout put in the discount code Mafia State for your Guardian podcast offer.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.